Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present interviews with protesters on Inauguration Day who explain why they'd come to Washington, D.C. to oppose Donald Trump and his agenda. Climate activist Tim DeChristopher, who talks about the urgency of taking personal risks to protect the planet in the era of climate change denial promoted by President Trump and his administration. And Aaron Sherb of Common Cause, who discusses Donald Trump's many unresolved financial conflicts of interest and a federal lawsuit that claims his overseas businesses violate the Constitution's Emoluments Clause. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Further evidence of increasing global inequality can be found in a new report by the international aid group Oxfam, which says that the world's eight wealthiest billionaires, including Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Mark Zuckerberg, have amassed as much wealth as the poorest half of the world's population, some 3.6 billion people. Oxfam's report, An Economy for the 99%, was released on the eve of the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland, a gathering of the international business and political elite. Oxfam's research has revealed that over the last 25 years, the top 1% has gained more income than the bottom 50% put together, and almost half, 46%, of total income growth went to the richest 10%. This is important because the poorest 10% of the global population still live below the extreme poverty line of $1.90 a day. This comes at the same time that President Trump plans to cut corporate taxes, weaken regulations, and make it easier for rich families to avoid taxes by exploiting tax havens. Oxfam's director, Winnie Byanyima, declared, "Wages are stagnating, and corporate bosses take home million-dollar bonuses. It's obscene for so much wealth to be held in the hands of so few." The Dodd-Frank Act was passed in the aftermath of the 2008 financial meltdown, which brought big Wall Street banks to the brink of collapse. Dodd-Frank reforms, passed by Congress in the early days of the Obama administration, shored up the big banks and identified systemic risk in the nation's shattered financial system. However, the Dodd-Frank legislation avoided fundamental change, such as breaking up the big banks or reimposing the Glass-Steagall Act that separated commercial lending from investment banking. Among its reforms, Dodd-Frank created the Independent Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and established the Volcker Rule that restricted U.S. banks from making certain kinds of speculative investments. According to the American Prospect magazine, as of last summer, 25% of Dodd-Frank rules had not been completed. This included rules governing executive compensation and new powers for the clawback of executive bonuses resulting from corporate misconduct. However, the Trump administration, which has innumerable conflicts of interest with international banks, has promised a new wave of financial deregulation and could begin by simply telling enforcement agencies to stop working on completing unfinished Dodd-Frank rules and regulations. Red State Texas is the next stop for debate over the so-called bathroom bill. Yet, its prospects are uncertain, as the Lone Star State's powerful business community is opposed to the measure, fearing a backlash and boycotts. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, a Tea Party favorite, introduced the bathroom bill in early January. It closely resembles the controversial North Carolina law that required transgender people to use the bathroom corresponding to the sex on their birth certificates. The bill would also ban Texas municipalities from passing laws requiring or preventing private businesses from setting their own policies on how or whether to accommodate the different sexes in their bathrooms. Many Texas conservatives oppose the bathroom bill. Texas House Speaker Joe Strauss says the bill is not a priority, and the powerful Texas Association of Business calls the bill discriminatory and totally unnecessary legislation. Based on the boycotts targeting North Carolina's bathroom bill, Texas business lobbyists fear the bill could cost the state $8 billion in lost business, including the loss of the contract to host the lucrative NCAA Final Four games in San Antonio in 2018. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Not long after the November 8th election, thousands of Americans took to the streets in protest of a presidential election that many believe was stolen by an undemocratic, archaic electoral college system that installed Republican candidate Donald Trump in the White House, despite the fact that he had lost the popular vote by some 2.8 million ballots. Adding to the anger and fear across the country was Trump's unabashedly racist, xenophobic, and misogynist rhetoric that at times provoked violence targeting protesters who attended his campaign rallies. As the nation held its collective breath, waiting to see what a Trump presidency would bring, anti-Trump activists got busy organizing protest rallies to coincide with the presidential inauguration on January 20th. The most ambitious of these was what later came to be called the Women's March on Washington, which grew out of a modest effort launched on a Facebook page. Exceeding all expectations, the Women's March on January 21st swelled to become the largest national political protest in U.S. history. Protesters attending rallies in 673 cities and small towns in all 50 states across the U.S., as well as cities abroad, totaled more than 4 million. With one research team estimating that an amazing 1 in 10 Americans had joined one of the anti-Trump demonstrations that day. Between the Lines covered the protests in Washington, D.C., during the inauguration of Donald Trump, and the Women's March, which took place the following day. What follows is a series of brief interviews with people who explain in their own words why they had come from near and far to express opposition to Donald Trump and his agenda. We hear first from Robin, Kathleen, and Denise from North Carolina. I was just wanting to know what brought you here today.
Injustice and fear for my country and the world and the viability of our planet.
We are very concerned about Trump being president and the damage that he potentially can do to our country and human rights in general.
We believe that this president is unfit, that he was really illegally placed in office, that there are a lot of things happened before the election that were not kosher with the FBI investigation, with possible Russian hacking. We believe he really shouldn't be in office, that he really was illegally elected. We think he doesn't believe in science. He doesn't believe in global warming. He's a racist. He's a misogynist. We're very, very unhappy. So we drove from North Carolina to be here today to say no to Trump.
Peter from Washington, D.C. is a Vietnam veteran.
My sign says this veteran is embarrassed and ashamed and will resist.
Tell us a little bit what brought you out to the protest today at the inauguration.
I'm finding that President-elect Trump, soon-to-be President Trump, is probably the least qualified person ever to serve as president. I find him morally repugnant. I find him lacking in intelligence and curiosity and just ill-informed on so many policy issues. And I think it's important for the American people to come together, recognize what we're facing, the challenges we're facing, and to organize ourselves to prevent him from doing much damage over the next 4 years.
Pat traveled to Washington from New Fairfield, Connecticut.
My sign says, one person, one vote does not equal Donald Trump. He didn't. If we have a true democracy, it should be one person, one vote. He did not win the election. If we have a true democracy, we've got a plutocracy, we've got people who buy influence in government, we have people who gerrymander in rig elections. It's wrong. Why do the poor people on the West Coast even bother to vote? They're part of the country. It's wrong.
Ben, who lives in New York City, explains why he came to protest at the Trump inauguration.
Why I'm here today is so that all of the supporters of him can see the opposers, and so that they can at least see that there are people who are willing to come out here and say, no, we don't support this, as many as there are that say we do support this, so that then maybe they'll think twice before they say that harmful thing towards that person or they commit that harmful act. They'll think twice about their actions.
What are you planning to do over the next 4 years? Are you going to remain active? And if so, what is going to be your focus?
My focus right now, ideologically, is on the environment. Because that's what I worry about the most. Of course, we all know that he has promised to pull out of the Paris Accords, and he has appointed someone to his cabinet that's the CEO of Exxon. So things were already looking bleak before that. I think that's what I'm going to try to keep at the forefront of my mind over the next 4 years, because without a good infrastructure and without a good environment to sustain all of this and to sustain all this debate, how much of it matters? That's what I have to ask.
We next hear from Melinda of Frederick, Maryland. What's your big concern about Trump?
Everything he stands for, the entire Trump agenda. Number one thing is him and Pence trying to control women's bodies. Not even my husband controls my uterus. So neither will Congress, not the president, nobody will control what I do with my body. And then how they stand with immigrants. I'm half an immigrant. My dad's from El Salvador. My husband's from Asia. What, does he want to deport us? Everything that he stands for is just not right. It's not right.
And what is your plan for the next 4 years? How are you going to be active on these issues?
I'm just pretty scared, to be honest. I'm just worried and just people coming together, just coming together wherever people can. That's where I'll be, just fighting the Trump agenda, because we won't be able to accomplish anything unless we stand together and fight.
That was a series of interviews with people from all walks of life who came to Washington, D.C. on Inauguration Day to express their opposition to Donald Trump and his agenda. Learn more about the ongoing organizing being done by the Women's March Coalition and other groups by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Climate activist Tim DeChristopher spent 21 months in federal prison for a creative nonviolent direct action in 2008 that succeeded in stopping the auctioning of public lands in Utah for fossil fuel development. In 2015, he co-founded the Climate Disobedience Center, which works with groups and individuals who risk imprisonment for breaking the law in the interest of protecting the climate. The center's current focus is assisting five individuals in their support team who on October 11th last year turned off the valves of five pipelines that bring tar sands oil from Canada into four U.S. states. They're facing several criminal charges, including conspiracy, burglary, and trespass. In advance of the action, they took safety precautions and notified the pipeline companies. The group is now facing up to 30 years in prison. DeChristopher says these cases will test the rights of political dissidents in the Trump era. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with DeChristopher while on a break from painting banners in Washington, D.C., that would be used in a protest during the January 20th inauguration of Donald Trump as the 45th President of the United States. Here, Tim DeChristopher discusses the urgency of taking risks to protect the climate, and thereby human beings and other Earth species, who rely on a healthy, sustainable environment for survival.
A big part of our philosophy is trying to use the whole process of a civil disobedience action, not just up to the point of arrest, but through the trial, through jail support, through all of that, and to support folks through that whole process and help to make the most out of it for the movement as well.
Do you see any increase in the number of actions that are, you know, resulting in people going to trial as opposed to just paying a fine or doing community service?
Yeah, I think so. There's been a big increase in civil disobedience across the climate movement for the past 6 or 7 years now. And the first wave of that was a lot of the kind of catch-and-release style, prearranged kind of actions. And I think a lot of the people who got involved in those then got a taste of it and realized, oh, there's other opportunities here. There's more that we could be doing. So then as those people kind of grow as activists, then they try new ways of making their voices heard. And what happens out in the street is sort of one format of telling our story. And as folks have had some level of success with that, but realizing that, you know, we need to keep pushing harder, people have looked for new formats. And the courtroom is one of those formats where we can also tell our story and make our voice heard in a very different kind of way. And so a lot more folks, I think, are trying that and are having various levels of success in terms of how much of their story they're allowed to tell in the courtroom, particularly how much they're allowed to tell to juries rather than just to the judge. And I think that's something that, particularly in the Trump era, where we can get less and less positive results from our government officials and even government appointees and judges and things like that, I think we're going to be looking for more ways that we can rely on each other as citizens. And juries are one of those pieces of the system where we can actually support each other and protect each other's rights, no matter what draconian laws are passed, that we can say, no, as citizens, we're not going to enforce that on each other. We're not going to send people to prison for their identity or for their religion or for their political beliefs or their expression of their political beliefs in public spaces. And, you know, I think that's the kind of solidarity that we're going to be looking for more and more. And so I think it's important for folks to get that practice now. The judge and the prosecutor act like the juries are just there to enforce the will of the state, when the reality is that the role of a jury is to protect our fellow citizens from the government. That's what they're there for, is to protect fellow citizens from the government. If we trusted the government, we wouldn't need juries. That's why they're there. And I think particularly a lot of liberals have gotten into the habit of trusting the government. And I think now that puts us in an extremely vulnerable situation when we have such a hostile government that really just has no respect for our rights whatsoever. And so we need to get back in the habit of protecting ourselves from tyranny.
The concept of necessity defense, where people say, even admit to breaking a law, but said, you know, I broke the law to prevent a greater harm, which in this case, as you deal with, would be to try to stop the exploitation and burning of fossil fuels, which, you know, are cooking the planet and among many other ills. So is that the basis of the defense that the different groups are using, or are there all kinds of issues that they're using?
There are all kinds of defenses that folks are using. The necessity defense is one that fits very well with climate change, and certainly one that is kind of the go-to defense that we in the Climate Disobedience Center like to use when we get the opportunity. And the necessity defense, as a technical thing in legal terms, is something that has to be allowed by a judge. You know, it's to make that defense openly in court, where the judge gives the jurors instructions that they can acquit if they find that the defendant met the requirements of the necessity defense. That's pretty rare in civil disobedience cases and has yet to be successfully used for climate civil disobedience. But the basic concept of the necessity defense, interpreted more broadly, can be used even when the judge doesn't explicitly set up that situation to openly use the necessity defense. That argument can still be worked into a lot of different kinds of defenses. And there are variations on the necessity defense in terms of tapping into international law and the Nuremberg principles and things like that that can all be explored. But, you know, I think it's an area that our movement hasn't put a whole lot of resources and effort into. So there's still a lot of ground for experimentation and creativity there.
That was Tim DeChristopher of the Climate Disobedience Center. Learn more about the upcoming trials of the five climate activists involved in the October 11th pipeline shutdown action, including Climate Disobedience Center co-founder Ken Ward, whose trial begins on January 31st, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Well before his victory in the November 8th presidential election, Many legal observers express concern about billionaire real estate developer Donald Trump's potential for serious ethics violations should he win the White House. These conflicts include Trump and his family members' possible exploitation of the office of president for self-enrichment, and how the potential for profit and loss in the Trump business empire could influence his decisions on both domestic and foreign policy. After taking the oath of office on January 20th, the president has reiterated his refusal to address these conflicts, as previous presidents have done, through mechanisms such as the liquidation of all assets and then moving the proceeds to a blind trust. Instead, Trump says he'll transfer the day-to-day management of his business and wealth over to his two adult sons, Don and Eric. On the Monday following his inauguration, a federal lawsuit was filed by the nonpartisan group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, that asked the court to stop Trump from violating the Constitution's Foreign Emoluments Clause by illegally receiving payments from foreign governments with ties to Trump interests. Your reporter spoke with Aaron Sherb, Director of Legislative Affairs with Common Cause. Here he discusses Trump's conflicts of interest, lack of transparency, and what's at stake in the outcome of the recently filed federal lawsuit.
What we're really seeing with the Trump administration is an unprecedented amount of secrecy in any modern American presidency, and as well as in from the Republican Congress. I think from Trump not releasing his tax returns, despite calls from Republicans, Democrats, independents across the country, encouraging him to, despite that all modern American presidential candidates have released their tax returns, he has refused to do so. We've also called on him to fully divest his Trump organization, his 500-plus business entities that he is connected with or has ownership stake in. And he's assigned that to his two sons, and that's neither blind nor trustworthy when your two sons are managing your assets, and they know full well what decisions he's making, and that we think that's a vast, significant conflict of interest that has to be addressed, or else he's going to quickly lose faith of the American people in his presidency. All modern American presidents in recent years have put their assets in a blind trust or similar entity, I think, for the past 40-plus years, and he will be the first president not to do that. And we think that's a significant kind of, even though it's not legally required, it's kind of breaks with kind of cultural and political norms that sets a dangerous precedent for where American democracy could head.
Aaron, I've read that this emoluments clause in the U.S. Constitution is not court tested, and a counsel hired by the Trump administration basically has given him a pass on his refusal to either liquidate his assets or put them in a blind trust. What can you tell us about your reading of the U.S. Constitution versus Trump's advisory team?
Yeah, well, like you said, it's untested. We've never been in a situation like this before. And like you said, CREW had filed a lawsuit alleging that President Trump was violating the Emoluments Clause for his ownership of the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C. specifically, and that foreign governments, there's one case where foreign governments had planned to stay at another hotel, then they changed their reservation to stay at the Trump Hotel. And so it's difficult to kind of prove standing or to prove harm in this case. And again, since there's no real precedent to go off of, it's kind of uncharted territory that we're in. And so we're kind of taking a wait and see approach. So while we work with CREW a lot of the times, we're still, our lawyers are still kind of exploring how he might be in violation of the Emoluments Clause and looking at sort of other actions or kind of other remedies, just because it would be a extremely long, potentially long court battle, but it would certainly be an uphill challenge, though. I should say that the CREW is headed by former ethics czar from the Obama administration, as well as the former kind of ethics czar from the George W. Bush administration. So they both having that bipartisan credibility certainly gives a lot of weight to their lawsuit.
Aaron, just a final question. There seems to be a lot at stake here, given the fact that Donald Trump is the first president in modern American political history who's refused to release his taxes and has refused to liquidate his assets or place them in blind trust, really defying the tradition of presidents that preceded him.
if Donald Trump gets away with this, could this open the floodgates to devolution of ethics in government, not only for the office of president, but right on down the line to many other positions in the legislature and the like?
Yeah, and that's what Common Cause is concerned about and paying particular attention to, so that he hopefully has not kind of created a new political norm in not only the presidency, but for other elected offices. You might have seen the attention that he, or kind of the fire he's directed at the entity called the Office of Government Ethics, which helps ensure that federal officials don't have conflicts of interest and helps federal nominees and other federal workforce employees make sure that they don't have certain conflicts and kind of certifies them before they're able to start their job. And he's threatened to fire the head of this fairly small organization because it has been asking difficult questions of some of his cabinet officials and other federal employees. And so that's, again, just an extremely troubling sign. Concerned citizens around the country can contact their members of Congress to encourage them to support certain legislation that would help eliminate some of these conflicts of interest that the Trump administration has.
I'm not sure we named them, but just maybe summarize them quickly here before we have to go.
Yeah, so a couple of key things that we're focused on is, number one, trying to require the presidential candidates to disclose tax returns. That's not legally required, but it's certainly ingrained in American political culture. Another effort would ensure that presidents would have to release their personal financial disclosure forms the first year that they're in office. And like I said, again, the Office or the Ethics in Government Act doesn't require presidents to do that until almost a year and a half after they've taken office. And again, with President Trump, just given his vast financial fortunes, the American public deserves to see how his businesses are potentially profiting in the first year and a half in office. So we just need as many concerned citizens as possible to continue to highlight these critical issues to make sure that our American democracy can be strengthened and solidified.
That was Aaron Sherb, Director of Legislative Affairs with Common Cause. Find more analysis of Trump family financial conflicts of interest by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.